Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. I don't want to take much time for an opening monologue today because we have a full lecture for you from feminist author and activist Bell Hooks, who died this week at a tragically young age, I should add. There's lots I could say, but let me offer one thought that derives from a conversation I had with author Luis Fernandez, who teaches at the University of Arizona in Santa Fe. We were talking about the integral relationship between racism and capitalism, and this was inspired by a quote from Bell Hooks. I posed the question of whether racism could sustain itself in the absence of inequality, or whether inequality could survive without racism. The conclusion that I draw is that racism depends on inequality, and that without it, racism becomes nothing more than petty bigotry, with no cultural paradigms to nurture it. So the way to get rid of racism requires the elimination of inequality. But capitalism also depends on inequality. Luis's point was that therefore capitalism is fundamentally racist, a point that Bell Hooks made often and in various ways. Let's hear a talk by Bell Hooks now from a few years ago on the topic of ending domination.
It's not often I get a standing ovation before I've said anything. So I thank everyone involved in the year of Bell Hooks, but especially Carlin, especially Anna, and Kurt, who sort of helped make a lot of this setting and the occasion of remembrance of Cassandra and the power of feminist thinking and practice possible. Recently, I was asked how our nation could bring an end to white supremacy. I responded that we would all need to learn to love justice more than our race, class, sexuality, or any aspect of our identity. There is no greater moral and ethical crisis our nation faces than the loss of a collective awareness of the essential need for an ethic of justice as a fundamental pillar of democracy. Justice requires of us all a willingness to honor principles of ideal rightness. To be committed to justice, we must believe that ethics matter, that it is vital to have a system of shared morality. This is one of the many reasons a vision of justice has always been an essential foundation of a democratic vision. When Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation on January 4, 1863, he declared, "In giving freedom to the slave, we assure freedom to the free. Honorable alike is what we give and what we preserve." Now that there's a more genuine accounting of Lincoln's beliefs and values, it is evident that he cared more for the souls of white folks, about their integrity and wholeness, than he did about the freedom of black folks who were enslaved. Although Lincoln, as a state legislator, had deemed slavery unjust, he remained ambivalent. Lincoln wanted white men, himself among them, to be seen by the world as having integrity of mind, body, and spirit. To do so, they had to show themselves worthy by insisting on the meaning and value of justice and fair play. Even if important political white men like Lincoln did not believe in their heart of hearts that black folks were capable of being the equals of white folks, they could not declare democracy to be a state where all citizens were deemed equal, then deny the very notion of humanness to the slave. In keeping with this embrace of equality, Frederick Douglass was to say that the day the Emancipation Proclamation was signed was to be the most memorable day in American annals. He declared, quote, "The 4th of July was great, but the 1st of January, when we consider it in all its relations and bearing, is incomparably greater. The one had respect to the mere political birth of a nation. The last concerns," he writes, "the national life and character, and is to determine whether life and character shall be radiantly glorious with all high and noble values or infamously blackened forevermore. The Emancipation Proclamation represented the triumph of justice, of righteousness, of sin over evil. Throughout his life as a civil rights activist, Martin Luther King would lead the clarion call for equality for black citizens, reminding our nation of the importance of justice. Time and time again, he would tell audiences that justice at its best is love correcting everything that stands against love. More than any other contemporary freedom fighter, King encouraged black folks to see justice as a divinely ordained aspect of citizenship. He helped disenfranchise black folks believe that justice would be a natural outcome of black folks attaining equality. When full equality failed to emerge, King castigated political leaders, the church, the press, proclaiming in no uncertain terms that the absence, he writes, of brutality and unregenerate evil is not the presence of justice. Sadly, King's assassination and the death of progressive, powerful white leaders like the Kennedy brothers, the brutal public execution of Malcolm X, left black folks despairing that justice would triumph over injustice, which seemed to have become the new social order. All white American citizens were encouraged to believe that the reinstatement and reaffirmation of injustice was a necessary political move to ensure that black folks who had been accorded equality under the law would still exist in various states of inequality. Legal justice would still remain subordinated, held hostage to the psychological plantation of white supremacist imperialism. With prophetic insight, King understood that white citizens, even those who supported what he called ecstatic notions of equality with black folks, that's the idea that, you know, having one black friend was fine, one black neighborhood person in the neighborhood was accepted, were joined with their more openly and actively racist counterparts in actively fearing actual equality. Together, they helped maintain the racist status quo, for they feared losing their position of dominance. The more extreme the commitment to maintaining white supremacy, the greater the willingness to support unjust social practices. As early as the 60s, King called attention to the harsh reality that many white supremacists, whom he called unregenerate segregationists, openly declared that, quote, democracy was not worth having if it involved equality. This insight has proven to be true, and in King's day was most evident when he boldly acted as a citizen with equal rights and protested the war in Vietnam. At Riverside Church in 1967, King declared that the United States was the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. Many people don't remember that this speech caused him to be seen by many people as a traitor. There's a new book out about the I Have the Dream speech by Gary Young, and he highlights the reality that before King's death, he was well on his way to becoming a pariah. Even before the Riverside Church speech, Young explains, in 1966, twice as many Americans had an unfavorable opinion of him as a favorable one. Life magazine branded his anti-Vietnamese Vietnam War speech a demagogic slander. A huge majority of Americans deemed King a traitor and believed he needed to be silenced. It was just one of many occasions where democratic rights were trumped by the true white demagogue's desire to control the actions of black leaders. After King's death, more and more citizens opposed the war, thus clearing a path for King to be viewed by the nation not as a traitor but as an emissary of peace. Of course, it was easier to revere a dead king, one whose voice could no longer be heard speaking out against the injustice of racism, poverty, war, imperialism, than it was to celebrate the militancy of King's anti-imperialism. Reframed by mass media as the sentimental voice of I Have a Dream, King had renewed mass appeal. He could even be accepted by white racists, for his image had and has been colonized by the very conservative white supremacist folks he opposed. As King had predicted, many white folks could embrace the notion of racism ending as long as overall white supremacist domination remained intact. Against this backdrop of what initially appeared to be cultural support for racial equality, racial segregation remained and remains a social norm. Even the election of a black president has proved to be more a triumph of white supremacist domination than a sign of overall racist equality becoming a truly accepted, racial equality becoming a truly accepted norm. Obama's election raised hopes that racism in the U.S. was truly ending. Those hopes were dashed when it became evident that a new system of racial exclusion was in place, wherein an individual black person might appear to be the equal of white folks while being constantly controlled by white power. As Obama was ushered into the White House, white supremacy was actually on the rise. Commenting on this fact, journalist Robert Perry contends, "It is now clear that Obama's election in 2008 was not the harbinger of a post-racial America, but rather the signal for white right-wingers to rally their friends to, quote, take back America." Furthermore, he states, "There is now a white supremacist nihilism emerging in the Republican strategy, a visceral contempt for the idea of a multiracial democracy that favors a more rigorous federal government." Tragically, most American citizens are not horrified and alarmed by this blatant assault on democratic ideals. Unjust political practices, everyday racism, racial terrorism have all chipped and are chipping away at the foundations of democracy. As more covert forms of racial injustice prevail, as black folks who spoke out against racism were and are castigated for refusing to embrace the notion that racism has ended, racial injustice is becoming more and more an accepted norm. Again, with prophetic insight, King had warned our nation that without a focus on justice and democracy, there would be a resurgence of white supremacist power. He warned the nation, telling folks that the segregationist goal is the total reversal of all reforms, with reestablishment of naked oppression, and if need be, a native form of fascism. I find it so fascinating that Dr. King was writing about the potential threat of fascism, and that's rarely talked about. The recent Supreme Court decision that undermines the Voting Rights Act typifies this trend. On one hand, conservative mass media bombards the public with news of a growing colored population that will replace white folks, and they will be in the minority, suggesting that possibly this could be a positive sign of diversity. But really what it has led to is many white people feeling white people need to band together to protect whiteness. These beliefs ensure that white supremacist domination both here and in the world will remain a ruling force, and that colored folks everywhere will live in various states of inequality. The ultimate wish of white supremacy is that non-white folks, black folks, will live in sustained suicidal genocide. King understood, quote, that America had a master race in the antebellum South, and that reestablishing white supremacist dominance along with a, quote, totally disenfranchised lower class was the dream of the many extremists on the right. Were King alive, he would be witnessing a rise in the very overt form of fascism that seeks to crush democracy. He would also see that masses of black folks have become utterly and permanently despairing and disenfranchised. He would study the work of Michelle Alexander, who wrote the book, The New Jim Crow, and see all the ways labeling black females and males criminal felons deprives them of basic citizenship. He would see that prisons in this nation have become the newfangled concentration camps. He would be appalled at the sanctioned murder of black males, random state-sanctioned executions that serve as modern-day warnings that black folks, especially black males, can be easily eliminated if they are seen to be out of their place, if they do not obey. If King saw all this, he would once again, as he once stated, quote, weep at funeral services for the dead and no for democracy. No one understood better than King that the foundation of democracy would crumble if it were not for citizens willing to stand for justice. No doubt he would weep to see the way the ideals of justice have all but disappeared from our national discourse. By the mid-70s, the belief that a democratic nation would always uphold justice had been so severely diminished that citizens of all races began to accept that corruption and injustice were becoming the way of politics, the way of life in our society. Throughout the country, the seeds of that, quote, naive form of fascism King warned about were and are fast taking root. In Hervé Kempf's insightful treatise, How the Rich Are Destroying the Earth, he identifies the shift from democracy to oligarchy, defined as a government in which a small group exercises control, pointing out that, quote, unbridled consumption driven by the oligarchy wounds justice by virtue of its unequal distribution. Further, he adds, the global oligarchy wants to get rid of democracy and the civil rights and public liberties that constitute its substance. Democracy, he writes, has become antithetical to the objectives the oligarchy seeks. Democracy favors opposition to unwarranted privilege. It feeds doubt that illegitimate powers. It pushes for the rational examination of decisions. It is consequently, Kempf writes, more dangerous all the time during a period when the harmful tendencies of capitalism are becoming more obvious. In the United States, mass media demonizes the poor by blaming poverty on the people it victimizes and making it appear that they are monstrous. Black folks are disproportionately numbered among the poor and are the most demonized. For some time now, despair and a sense of pervasive defeat has permeated diverse black communities. King had cautioned black folks about wholeheartedly embracing the attitudes and values of the dominant culture, declaring, "Let us therefore not think of our movement as one that seeks to integrate the Negro into all the existing values of American societies. Let us be those creative dissenters who will call our beloved nation to a higher destiny, to a new plateau of compassion, to a more noble expression of humanness." King would not have understood black folks' uncritical embrace via racial integration of liberal individualism. He would not have ever imagined that spiritual beliefs, which had always served the foundation for anti-racist resistance, would cease to matter for many black folks once liberal individualism offered the pseudo-culture of choice, whereas it was acceptable to repudiate spirituality. Ironically, while integration did not set the stage for racial equality to emerge, it did create the context for the assimilation of the very values King warned against. And here I go on to talk about hedonistic materialism and addiction. Addiction in our society knows no class or race boundaries. It is as problematic in the lives of privileged class folks as it is among the poor, but it has a different impact. Class privilege affords addicts a location where they can seek and find diverse avenues of healing. It is especially difficult for poor folks of color, for black folks who are addicts, to find help. So I go on and talk about the whole impact of the trauma of slavery and public shamings, particularly writing about the Trayvon Martin case and how there's been such an emphasis on shaming black people like we are somehow responsible. And of course, many of you saw Fruzell Connection and you saw that even in the face of seeing the terrorism against black males, many people still feel like black males are themselves at fault. Blame is simply not useful. It simply becomes another form of dominator terrorism. If there is to be a major effort to uplift democracy, to challenge change, and move beyond white supremacy, the focus must be on accountability rather than blame. Accountability invites recognition of our own agency. This means that diverse groups of people of color, of black folks, must be willing to examine the ways white supremacy undermines our well-being, both for the individual and the collective. More than ever before in our nation, there is little true resistance to white supremacy, especially as it impacts the lives of people of color, of black people. To move beyond white supremacy, we have to move in the direction of decolonizing the mind, of better mental health. Most black people, even extreme conservatives, will acknowledge that King was on target when he talked about the need to develop healthy self-esteem. Yet when one's sense of self is daily overdetermined by a system that will not acknowledge your humanity, then there must be major avenues of resistance to create a context for healthy well-being. Before he won the presidency, Barack Obama was asked by Michelle Obama what he thought he could accomplish if he were to win. He replied, "The day I take the oath of office, the world will look at us differently, and millions of kids across the country will look at themselves differently. That alone is something." Without addressing directly issues of damaged self-esteem caused by white supremacy, Obama's response indicated his awareness of the issues in black life, revealing his awareness that his presence as president gives hope that racial equality can be achieved, that black children can look at him and see that they can have equal opportunity. In Gary Young's book On the Dream, he talks about an occasion where two brothers, Jacob and Isaac, who are children of one of the president's employees, get to meet him. And the story is told that Jacob declared, "I want to know if my hair is like yours." He was so quiet that Obama asked him to repeat the question. They were given the freedom to ask two questions. Obama said, "Why don't you touch it and see?" He bent down and lowered his head so that it was within reach. The boy had to be encouraged by Obama to touch. And when he did, he reported, "Yes, it does feel the same." Since Jacob was not interviewed after this meeting, there is no way to know what prompted the question. Yet clearly, there is the implication that a real black male, i.e., someone like himself, could not be president, so that he had to find out by touching to actually see that Obama was like him. Even though many black folks saw Obama's election to the presidency as a sign that race no longer matters, ongoing racial discrimination is the living proof that our nation has not made significant progress in eradicating racism. In Tim Wise's useful book, Colorblind, he contends, quotes, that Obama's election, far from serving as evidence that racism had been defeated, might signal a mere shifting of racism from racism 1.0 to racism 2.0, an insidious upgrade that allows millions of whites to cling to racial stereotypes about people of color generally, while nonetheless carving out exceptions for those who, like Obama, make us comfortable by seeming so different from what we view as a much less desirable norm. Throughout this book, Tim Wise offers substantial documented facts revealing that everyday racial biases, both in our everyday lives and in the world around us, abound. I go on to talk about how differently we would be dealing with racism if, in fact, Obama had spoken more about issues of white supremacy, if our government had taken the lead role in stopping the demonization of the poor, who are themselves socialized by dominator culture to believe they can have no access to healthy self-esteem. Imagine if instead of focusing on weight, we were developing programs for healthy self-esteem that were placed alongside the political agenda. Our culture would be profoundly changed for the better if children were given early education in ways to build healthy self-esteem. It's important that we focus on children. I'm excited about our day tomorrow with children. I don't often get asked to speak to 100 children. That many of the values and beliefs learned in childhood form the content of our character, our sense of self. Citizens of our nation who see themselves as anti-racist, irrespective of their color, often live in a culture of paradox. On one hand, they become enraged at overt acts of racial aggression, while on the other hand, allowing children in their lives to be daily bombarded by a mass media that covertly and overtly socializes them to think and practice white supremacy. Very few folks are constantly critically vigilant when the issue is resisting white supremacy. And children, who are the most vulnerable, are not protected from white supremacist assaults on their minds and bodies, especially if it comes in the form of entertainment. Those of us who have actively decolonized our minds as adults begin that process by a symbolic rebirthing and reparenting of ourselves. For many of us, that process began as we were seeking a way out of psychological pain. We looked to therapy for help. We learned from progressive visionaries, and we read great books. The process of decolonization remains more a self-help project in our society than a formal, structured system of transformation. I consider all the writing that I've done to be aimed at challenging and changing domination in all its forms. Actively challenging imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist patriarchy, this work acts to aid readers in the process of decolonization. It is fundamentally about healing, linking the work of ending domination with efforts to create a society where commitment to democracy, to peacemaking, and justice is a way of life. Exploring the meaning of justice in their wonderful book, Parenting for Peace and Justice, Kathleen and James McInnes define justice as the progressive realization of people's economic rights, the material necessities of life, cultural rights, their dignity as individuals and as people of color or culture, and political rights, their participation in decisions that affect their lives, their being, that they can be artisans of their own destiny. By justice, they write, we also mean the progressive realization of people's duty of solidarity, working with others for the common achievement of these rights. To make justice an everyday fact of life is crucial because it allows us to acknowledge differences and the myriad ways race matters, while making it clear that it is not the only aspect of our identity that's important. Earlier today, someone, a white male, was making this whole difference between myself and Carlin and saying, you know, basically saying about me that I was one of the black thinkers that had written about how black women are different. And I said, yes, I have written about difference, but my overall belief is that solidarity comes not from overemphasizing our difference, but from looking at the ways in which we may have a shared vision of unity, of solidarity, of beloved community, which is what I feel I have established with Carlin and now with Anna. I begin this essay talking about justice because learning to affirm the power of justice daily is the way to build a firm foundation from which decolonized resistance can emerge. All the knowledge of what must happen in our society for a culture of justice to be the norm is already available to us. When we create the context for justice, we create a culture where love exists. At its core, white supremacist thinking and practice pushes hate. It is fundamentally anti-love. Throughout his life, King linked the struggle for justice with the work of love. And as I've declared in many of my writings, anytime we do the work of ending domination, we are doing the work of love. Thank you. That I find reading lectures a bit of an ordeal. And in the future world of bell hooks, I'm not going to be reading lectures. I'm going to be engaging in exciting, thrilling conversations. We have lots of time. What time is it? We have lots of time to dialogue together. If you have a question, say your name, be loud, be bold, be quick. If you start to give a talk, I always say, with Buddhist compassion, I will ask you to stop. So who's ready? It's hard to see in here. Team Hooks is coming with a microphone. So stand up if you're trying to ask a question. Right here, there's a question. Your name?
Francesca.
Francesca, the mic is coming your way.
I'm told I should tell you I flew in from Pennsylvania just to see you. I'm actually from a different university. I wondered because I'm getting my doctorate and I wish to be a professor, and one of the things that just got brought up in our class was the fact that our program, we like to sort of pretend we don't have racism or homophobia or classism, but it's been a real problem to address it because no one wants to talk about it. So how can we as academics and teachers recognize and teach our students to recognize and to talk about racism and classism without pointing at African-American scholars as yourself as the other and saying, here are the people who know about it, and sort of acknowledge that we are all human, everybody has the valid point, and...
Well, I mean, I think that that's, again, why solidarity is important, but also we're learning from each other. I mean, recently in my school, we had a student who, a black male student, very lovely, very bright, who hung himself last year. And so we had a big push on campus for why don't we have mental health workers that are black? And, of course, we got the pushback from white people who were saying, well, why do they have to be black? You know, and recently we did... our campus did hire sort of marginally a black female therapist. And then recently I heard that, well, we're not offering her a full-time job because white folks at the counseling center feel threatened. And I said, well, if they feel threatened, that means that we have not done our work. That is to say, we have not done our work of teaching people about the nature of difference, about when it's appropriate to acknowledge the force of identity politics, that many black people don't... I mean, therapy, of which I've had so much because I've been so messed up, you know, is one of the areas very much of racial... You know, there are odd pockets of racial apartheid in our culture. Hairdressers are one. You know, white people rarely go, if ever, to black people to get their hair done. Black women, especially, rarely go to white salons to get our hair done. But the other thing is therapy. Most of us are more likely to choose a therapist who is like ourselves. And so whether you think that's good or bad, I know my therapist is like comes from a poor white trash trailer background and is overweight and very unglamorous, but she has helped me over the years heal in so many ways. And so I've come to see that, again, it's not the color of a person's skin, it's the quality of the therapy they can offer. But for many black people, I remember the first time I went to a therapist, the therapist said that I was poison. I'd gone with the black man I was with, and she was like, you two are poison for each other. You should get away from each other. And I was like, wow. You know, so that, I mean, there are specific reasons why many people of color and black people in general fear going to a white mental health person for care. And so I think that it's up to us as aware people of all colors to be able to teach the other white people around us why that's important, to have the dialogues. I mean, I'm a little bored and tired of workshops. I'm more excited by situations where we come together and somebody puts the problem on the table. Like for somebody to ask, why would you choose, I tend to choose a woman, irrespective of her color, therapist over a male. And it's not because I don't believe there are good male therapists out there. I know my comfort zones. So that it's like, how can we teach and talk about that rather than having yet another endless discussion about racism? And I think we're so much better at talking about the problem than looking at ways that we can resolve the issues. And even to think about, today at dinner we were talking about, I use a lot of sentence endings in my classrooms. Like one might ask students to think about, why do you believe racism doesn't exist? You know, what are the signs that racism is over? Because one thing Buddhist teacher Pema Chodron teaches me is start where you are. And we have to go to people where they are. So rather than trying to be angry at somebody who thinks racism does not exist, I'm interested in what do they see as the evidence that racism does not exist. And why? Why is it so important to believe that it doesn't exist, that it doesn't hurt us? What are so many white people afraid of in having to face that, yes, racism causes us pain, and it happens in our daily lives again and again, every day. And of course, the most virulent form of it is the kind of racism that we saw in Fruitvale Connection. You know, where you see all of these people so afraid of the fascist terrorism of the police that they can do nothing, white or black or Latino. I mean, just the way fear paralyzed people. I'll be shorter in my next answer, if I have an answer. Your name over here while they're bringing you the mic. Stand up and be loud. She doesn't trust me.
Hi, I was going to...
Your name?
My name is Sophie. I forgot my own name. I was going to ask, this is more a question about feminism, because I hear both men and women tell me, oh yeah, I believe in equality between men and women, but I'm not a feminist. So it's, I was wondering, how did feminism become such a negative word in your opinion?
But I think that, let's face it, let's not fall for bullshit. People, a lot of times, people will act like they don't understand something, but the truth is, they really do understand. And I think that, to me, feminism is just one of the most powerful, wonderful political movements our nation has ever known. It's one of the few political movements where people actually stopped, criticized themselves. I mean, when we put the issue of race on the agenda, white feminists stepped up to the plate and said, we have to reevaluate what we were thinking. We haven't seen the left do that. We haven't seen black males black power advocates do that. So feminism is really kind of amazing if you look at the reality of feminist movement. But if you look at how media and different things, present feminism, then you get this sort of distortion that makes people, younger people, not want to claim feminism. It's like, okay, all day I've been talking about my search for love and whether I was going to find love here at St. Norbert's. I mean, I am willing to look everywhere. But for a while in my life, I started to get really paranoid. I think I'm cute, you know, I'm smart, I have good humor. Why can't I find love? And the interesting thing is when I would ask people, they would say always sort of negativities about me. You are too intimidating. You are this. And I would listen to that bull. And I would just sort of, okay, like, this is deep. Everybody's saying this. Cross race, cross class. And I thought, why is nobody saying patriarchy is evil and violent and cruel? And for feminist women and men who advocate feminist politics, seeking love is not easy in patriarchal society. So that, you know, why is it no one willing to pinpoint patriarchy as the problem, but then want again for me as a woman to be self-blaming, as a black woman to be self-blaming? And it seems to me that all of that is part of the not-so-subtle undermining of feminism. I mean, I was telling people at dinner that there's this book called Living Solo, and it's all about how more Americans are living by themselves than ever before, and that the huge number of those people are women. And the author, white male author, kind of makes it seem like this negative happening is sort of due to feminism. And again, I said, well, that's bull. It's really due to women being fed up, hetero women, with patriarchal terrorism in the domestic household. Lots of women that are choosing to be alone who are hetero aren't choosing to be alone because they're feminist. They may be very patriarchal, but they may be fed up with domestic violence, with verbal abuse, with all the things that they may have endured over the years. I can't, because I'm always talking to professional women who are alone, and lots of women say to me, girl, I don't want to be married again. I'm over that. And it's because of the place of domination and male domination. And we don't want to talk about male domination in intimate relationships, because that's the other thing, that we want to act like it's all cool. You know, I can just talk about my husband. Jay-Z. I'm Mrs. Carter. You know, I can be so bad. You see, this is a problem when I give these evening talks. I'm tired, and I'm liable to say anything. Let's have another question. Yes? Be loud. Let's not waste so much time waiting on the mic. Your name?
Kirsten.
Hey. So in the back, did you hear her say, what could she do to help people as someone moving into the field of social work to help people build self-esteem? Again, I want to go back to Pema Chodron, who says, start with where people are. I think we have to hear where people are. We have to listen to someone talk about what their needs and desires are. And whether, you know, there's realism to those needs. A lot of my students who are troubled bring desires and needs that are very unrealistic to the table. And so that part of listening to them and loving them is actively hearing and breaking down, you know. Like, for example, my sister, she's gone from Flint, but she lived in Flint for 36 years, one of them, and she was in the public school. And her husband was an auto worker, and he had this disdain for teachers. He always, you know, made a point of saying how he made so much more money than teachers. So my sister would always make me go to the little school programs with the little kids. And the first thing they'd want to know is, well, what kind of car do you drive? And Carlin has been finding out that I'm a little obsessed with cars. And so I drive very cute, very fancy, very sexy cars. And it's interesting, again, starting where people are. You've got a fifth grader asking you, what kind of car do you drive? And, of course, I say, well, my favorite car that I have is my little BMW X3 Series, the little two-seater convertible. Oh, they have new respect for me. I'm not just somebody who writes books. But then they talk about how, well, they don't want to be teachers. Teachers don't make any money. So I ask them, well, what kind of car do you want to drive? Okay, you know, one thing I know is cars. If you want to drive a Maserati and this is what it costs, how are you planning to get the money to buy that car? So that we can break it down to not me trying to tell them that a car is not important, that you shouldn't have fantasies about a car, but that we can break it down concretely to how do you go about getting that car? You know, and where I can say, these bell hooks books. You know, I was involved with a man for a while, very short, where I would have to travel to see him. And at one point he said to me, you know what your problem is? The finger. I can't take the finger. You know what your problem is? You think too much. And I was like, that's interesting. The money that got me here comes from the fact that I think. And at the end of the day, if you don't like the fact that I think, you don't really like me. And so I stopped seeing this gentleman, but he just couldn't understand what the problem was. What was the problem? He was just trying to get me to lighten up a bit. You know, I mean, so that I think that when we talk about healthy self-esteem doesn't mean that I didn't get involved with this person or have a few good times with him, but that when I realized his basic contempt for thinking women, that I had the good sense to quickly move away from him and to make it evident why I was doing so. And I think that, again, start with people where they are. Even, I mean, with children, we have to start where they are and not presume that they're not capable of critical thinking, of theory making, and answer those questions. Because I think, especially around race and gender, we shut down kids very quickly. You know, it's like my goddaughter came to me when she was like 10, and she was like, I think I'm a lesbian. And I was like, oh, have you talked to your mother about this? And she was like, no, I thought it would be better to talk to you. And I was like, oh, really? Because, you know, when kids come to you, you have to be aware of that parent that's in the background. And I was like, okay, start where you are. I said, what makes you think that you are a lesbian? Oh, well, I kissed a girl at camp. And I was like, oh, that's not bad. That's kind of not a big deal. You may kiss a lot of people at camp between 10 and 15. Let's hold on to the idea of being a lesbian, but let's also think about who knows what you're going to be. You know, I mean, right now she's a transgender warrior. You know, but who knows? And how do we respond? How to not shame someone? How to take seriously her own sense of this is who I am? And that's why I think Pema is just, she's a magical teacher in Buddhist circles, in that sense of making people think about who they are, where they are, and what they can do for themselves. Another question? Yes, your name. Stand on up and tell me that name again, loud and clear. Oh, thank you, Lawrence University people.
How do you transform rage into love? Because it's so easy to like be angry and be like, the system, let's like revolution and all that. But like, how do you like transform that rage into love and make like change?
Well, I was telling this old story today. I had a boyfriend then that I was going to meet Thich Nhat Hanh. And I was really fighting with my boyfriend. I felt a lot of rage towards him. It seemed like every step of the way on my journey to Thich Nhat Hanh, I was just experiencing so much racism. And, you know, by the time I was like meeting the teacher and I was wanting to be, you know, the dutiful servant of the teacher, calm and receiving, and I opened my mouth, and what came out was, I'm so angry! And I just felt such shame at my rage. And there was Thich Nhat Hanh. He says, hold on to your anger and use it as compost for your garden. And of course, in the presence of the teacher, I thought, oh yeah, I can do that, you know? But I think that what Thich Nhat Hanh gave me that I hadn't found in a lot of self-help books was no condemnation of my rage. In fact, he said, especially about the boyfriend, he was like, well, I think you should, you know, you should express your rage. You should tell him, I feel like killing you right now. Sweetly tell him that. But then he said, you should remember. Then you should step back and remember what brought you to this person. What did this person have that enchanted you? And so I think that dealing with our rage, owning it, but thinking of it as something that we can transform. I know that Kurt Voss doesn't like, you know, he doesn't like to be put on the spotlight, but one of the things I think about Kurt, both what I thought of him and then thinking of him before meeting him, was the idea of his grief, because anger and grief are often tied together. They both often come from feelings we have of helplessness or powerlessness. And one of the things that I deeply admire about Kurt is the way that he took his grief. Do you know that the average couple in our culture that loses a child, whether adult child, that couple, if they're married, they end up separating. It's such a hard trauma for people to deal with. And so for Kurt, that he took that grief and transformed it into this amazing effort to have the center continues to awe me and remind me of what we can do with those emotionalities that can destroy us. Unrelenting grief can destroy us. For a lot of people, anger is eating away at us. And so how to take that and use it as compost for our garden. So, I mean, when you walk by the Cassandra Voss Center, I want you to think of it as this is what compost made. This is what taking the lead and making it to gold, into gold did. And that's the challenge for all of us. How do we live in this culture of domination in such a way that we can be free people? You know, in my new book, which I wanted to read some, Moving Beyond Race, I tried to think about, how do we live beyond race and racism while we're within white supremacist culture? You know, how do we live beyond patriarchy and homophobia while we are in this culture? It takes a lot of work to be vigilant about who you allow into your home. You know, I was going to a church that I really liked, And then the church started espousing all this homophobic stuff, and I was like, you know what? I don't come to church to hear hate. But I thought, well, before I drop the church, I'm going to go talk to the pastor about it. And, you know, and he was saying it wasn't him, it was other people in the church, that he'd worked on his own ideas about gay people and changed and transformed. And the church is very different. So that I think, again, how do we move past anger, fear, grief? I sometimes think Black people are caught in collective grief about the fact that there's still so much injustice, that you think, today it's going to be over with. Today people are going to, you know, we've got Obama. I mean, isn't that what a lot of people thought, that Obama was like a light heralding the end to certain forms of racialized darkness? And then it didn't happen. And so people felt kind of crushed once again. How can we go forward? So, okay, that was a bit long-winded. I am going to be hopefully writing new stuff about spirituality because I feel that people are searching for where is the light within the darkness and where do you find it? You know, where do I find it in my own life when dealing with grief? One of my sisters died in July, and she had a very horrible, awful death that was in many ways tied to patriarchy. And I felt, and race, such anger, such rage, and the fact that I had money, I couldn't intervene on the patriarchy of her son and the choices that were made about her life. And that plunged me into a deep feeling of sorrow and grief about, well, what is it all for, Bell Hooks? If you can't even change, affect the life of your sister, that patriarchy can step right in at the time of death and take over. I mean, this is why I'm not a big person who's into marriage. I would like all of us to have civil rights. I would like to know that if I lived in loving kinship with somebody for 20 years, whether we had sex or not, that person would be able to claim me as their kin and visit me if I'm in a hospital, and that we wouldn't have to be married for that to happen. So that I urge all of us to think about a resurgence of our struggle for civil rights, for rights that involve people who are not moneyed, who don't have inheritance, but who may share a life together, who may share total care and kinship, and what happens to them. Okay, since I'm on my little bailiwick, I've been telling people earlier that one of my big issues is I feel we should be able to have assisted death. And part of why I feel that way, I think it's a feminist issue, is that women are doing the lion's share of the care for our elderly and our sick. And what's happening to a lot of women, which is another one of my sisters, who cared for mom and dad, but then after mom and dad passed, she was herself really ill. And who's caring for her? And so I hope that feminist thinkers will begin to put more elder care and the gendered relationship of elder care on the table, and the question of a physician-assisted death. My mother died of Alzheimer's, but while she still had lucidity, she wanted to die. She wanted to leave her life with the dignity and joy that she had lived it. But our society didn't allow for that, and she too had a horrible dying, a sad dying, incarcerated in the very sad, you know, homes that we put elderly people in, especially elderly people of color. Okay, another question.
Here I am. I'm back here.
Okay.
Back here, Dr. Hook.
I can't see you, baby, but I can hear you.
I'm on your left side.
Okay.
I mean my right side, your right side.
Okay.
Hi.
I see you.
You're good. I'm Shawnee Daniel Sykes. I'm an associate professor of theological ethics at Mount Mary University in Milwaukee.
All right.
Thank you for your lecture. One of the things that I always ponder is the various definitions of justice. And I realize that in a liberal democracy, we're really talking much about the individual and individual justice. And as I, and we're also talking about a utilitarian justice, and we're also talking about a libertarian justice, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which all are undergirded by an individualist ethic. And so when I think about that and our conversations that also include the individual in the context of community, a communitarian justice, I always wonder in the language that we use as we talk about justice, what do we really mean?
Well, that's why I gave that quote for parenting from peace and justice in the way that they talked about what they perceive justice to be. Because I think we do need clear definitions and shared definitions, just as I think we need clear definitions of feminism and shared definitions so that people have a language. So I would urge people to read that book and to go over that definition of justice that I read. Speaking of justice, because many of you may know how much I didn't like 12 years a slave. I think I could have done better than what I did, calling it sentimental claptrap. But speaking of justice, one of the things I was reading recently was about a huge meeting that John Woolman and the Quakers called to discuss whether the Quakers should continue to support slavery. And the meetings from that meeting, the statements from it are so profound, but the thing that really struck me was that they made a decision that they would pay back wages to the slaves, that they would stop owning slaves, but they would also pay those wages. I want to say that's the movie I want to see, because that is a movie that says people can change, white people can change, that we can make amends, that we can make reparations to one another. You know, I'm not interested in the same old images of victimization. I was like, if I don't see another naked black woman being raped and beaten in my life, I will be just fine. You know, I'd rather see that really dull movie of bell hooks sitting and writing 30-some books all by herself. You know, you wish you had, like, video moments. I remember the night in New York City, because New York City is such a wicked city. You know, a lot of times in winter, you're paying big rent, but you may not have any heat. And I always remember that I had gone to see Pulp Fiction, and the film had disturbed me so. And then when I came home to my fifth-floor walk-up, there was no heat. And I remember putting on my stocking cap and my coat and my gloves and sitting down and writing that piece that I wrote about Pulp Fiction. And there was this passion there and this, like, I want to see movies that give us those images of black femaleness and women of colorness, where we are claiming a certain power over our subjectivity, our destiny, over what we see. Another question? Thank you so much.
The late Bell Hooks speaking a few years ago at St. Norbert College. She wrote more than 24 books. I'm afraid I've only read a couple of them, but to my knowledge, they're all still in print and well worth the time. And thank you for spending this time with us here on Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time in your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll be with you again next week for another edition. Take care. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM. WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.